Before I begin, I'd just like to acknowledge that anything cool you see today is entirely due to the amazing postdocs and graduate students that I've been working with on the projects that I'll describe. So Jonathan Braden at CETA, Alex Jenkins at University College London, and Dalila Purvu, who's here. So let me talk about what we usually mean when we do cosmology. Cosmology is kind of like archaeology, right? So we have these limited and imperfect records of the past. And then luckily, you know, like, thank God, for most of the history of the universe, we can use linear theory. And so that allows us to connect the stuff that we go out and observe today, these limited and imperfect records, to theories that are calculable and that we can simulate. And that's pretty much why cosmology is a science, so yay. And we've been undertaking this enterprise for quite some time now, where we compare theory with what we observe, and we iterate, and we get to learn more and more and more. But if we go back to the really early universe, we're a bit in a quandary. Because right now we measure two numbers, effectively, that are relevant for the really early universe, you know, the amplitude, the shape of the primordial power spectrum. And nature has not yet been kind enough to give us any further information. And so, you know, there's little information left over. There's lots of unknown and potentially new physics associated with the early times. And quantum effects are important. Okay, so in principle, we need to talk about quantum and gravity in the same sentence. That's what we're all here, I guess, to figure out and learn about. But it'd be great if we had some new handles or new tools to learn about this that go beyond this paradigm of predicting, observing, and iterating, because that might not be so useful if we just get two numbers. So let's talk about quantum and cosmology. So I don't mean this to be like derogatory in any way, but easy quantum, meaning we can calculate things with perturbation theory. So what's the paradigmatical, like, easy quantum in the early universe? For example, in the paradigm of cosmic inflation, we can have an epoch of inflation driven by a scalar field. We know how to calculate the quantum fluctuations as the field slowly rolls down a potential and translate that into stuff we observe, like the microwave background fluctuations. And that's like almost as easy as solving the harmonic oscillator in quantum mechanics, so that's something even I can do. And hence, easy. And then there's hard quantum, and that's kind of what I want to focus on for the rest of this talk. And I'll give you a few examples of what I mean by hard quantum. But in general, I mean things that are nonlinear, non-perturbative, involve things like strong coupling. And we just don't have very many tools to compute and to learn about these different types of phenomena. And since I don't have too much time, and I saw how many questions got asked yesterday, I have very few slides, and I'll have one thing that I'm just gonna like say something about, and then something that I hope to describe in detail. The thing I'm just gonna say something about is understanding the quote theory of De Sitter space. So how do we describe a space-time with a positive cosmological constant at a fundamental level? I really don't have much to say here. I have no good ideas, but I have an interesting observation and a question. And then the next thing I want to talk about, which I'll spend most of the time today discussing, is how we can better understand the decay of metastable or false vacua in scalar field theories. Okay, so something I thought a lot about like 20 years ago and then just never really thought about again because it was too hard, is De Sitter holography. So here's the question that I would love to answer. And I know a lot of people in this room probably thought pretty deeply about this question, but I think it's really one of the most fundamental questions in cosmology. So given the fact that we associate an entropy with event horizons, and a de Sitter space has an event horizon, we can count the entropy as basically how many pixels with an area L Planck squared can I tile the event horizon with? That's a counting of the entropy. And I just thought it was interesting. If you just compute how many bits that is and how much information it would just take to describe the states that are potentially associated with this finite entropy of the de Sitter horizon during inflation, it's like 100 terabytes. And I just thought that was really cool, because that's something you could fit on a hard disk. That's not an insanely huge amount of information. And in the context of this world we live in right now, which 20 years ago, probably I didn't really think about, right? Quantum computers, large language models. I think it would just be cool and interesting to revisit this question. Like, can we describe the full state of the inflationary de Sitter if this is all there is, right? If this entropy is really counting the number.
Classical bits?
Yeah, good question, Ted. I don't know. Like I said, that's not my job today to answer. But if we equate this entropy to some number of states, some counting states, right? How much information does it take to describe some configuration of de Sitter space, whatever the hell that means?
Yeah, but quantum configuration, I think, takes a lot more.
Okay. Possibly, like I said. Not my job to answer today. But then there's all these questions that I also don't have the answer to, which are probably maybe a little bit more fundamental, like what's the Hamiltonian? Can I translate it's a small system. One way of kind of understanding perhaps the inflationary density fluctuations is that I have a small system, there's not a lot of degrees of freedom, it's pretty likely to see deviations from equilibrium. And back of the envelope, if you consider the temperature and the probability of finding fluctuations, it gives you 10 to the minus 5, about the right number. There's lots more degrees of freedom today. What about then? How do we connect these things? What's the complex mapping of these states in an area to states in a volume? I don't know. I just wanted to say this and raise this question, because I think it's pretty cool that it's only 100 terabytes. And that's all I got to say about that. But why is it important? Because it's either finite or it's infinite. And if it's infinite, then maybe we have to deal with this picture of eternal inflation that I spent a lot of time thinking about and basically stopped thinking about because it hurts my brain and it's too hard to figure out. And I have no other good ideas to say about it. But I think it's among the most important questions. Just how many degrees of freedom does it take to describe a de Sitter space? Is it finite or infinite? And it has huge implications, so it's a really important question. Maybe computation and simulation can help. Okay, so that's my hand grenade. Now let's talk about something I can actually describe in more detail. And that is metastable false vacuum decay. So imagine I have some scalar field that has a potential with two local minima, one of which we'll call the false vacuum, has a higher energy density than the other one, which we'll call the true vacuum. So here's the Lagrangian. I've got some other stuff that I'm not going to talk about. And classically, if everywhere in space the field has this vacuum expectation value, then nothing happens. Okay, it just stays there forever. But quantum mechanically, there's the field theory analog of quantum tunneling that causes a region of space to form where we are in the true vacuum. And because the interior of this region has a lower energy density than the exterior, there's a pressure gradient, and this bubble forms and wants to expand. So quantum mechanically, we don't stay here forever, but in some places at least, you transition over to this other vacuum state, the true vacuum. So here's a little cartoon If I start everywhere in the false vacuum, pop, there's a bubble. It expands. At some later time, friends form. They expand. And if we wait long enough, and I'm in a universe that is not undergoing accelerated expansion, then this phase transition eventually completes, right? So this is some quantum mechanical first order phase transition where I go from the false vacuum state of the scalar to the true vacuum state at some late time. And this is an important phenomena or process that shows up kind of ubiquitously and beyond the standard model physics or even standard model physics. So it's related to questions of the stability of the Higgs vacuum we currently think we exist in, questions about the electroweak phase transition, various models of baryogenesis. You know, it was the original model for how does inflation end that didn't work, and then it became our favorite model for how inflation began, perhaps. You know, any kind of theories where we have multiple phases, we have to worry about this, and many more. So it'd be great if we could understand this process very deeply at a fundamental level and compute anything we want.
Can I ask a question that maybe helps to motivate this?
Sure.
Is related to things that came up earlier, namely the cosmological constant.
Yep.
So suppose at some time before a phase transition, the cosmological constant had been very small, some value that we think is nice. Does the phase transition change the cosmological constant?
Could, yeah. Depends, I guess.
I mean, generically.
Probably. Yeah, you change the vacuum energy, so probably, right? Yeah.
Right. Yep. So I always want to emphasize that as a feature or aspect of the cosmological constant puzzle that's never emphasized enough. If you had solved it before some phase transition that happened, then your solution gets screwed up after the phase transition.
Yep, that is true.
I don't agree with that, but we should discuss it.
Okay, good.
I want to be involved. Okay, so let's talk about sort of the fundamentals of this vacuum decay process. So it's a hard, one of the hard quantum problems. In fact, I think this is my poster child of hard quantum problems in the early universe, sort of a something to really get a hold of. So it's non-perturbative feature of nonlinear quantum field theories. In this case, the nonlinear means nonlinear potential. It's not just a massive scalar. So that's hard, and we might learn something new. Well, right now, with pencil and paper, we know how to compute basically the decay rate. And that's about it, okay? And that leaves a lot to be desired. So we can't talk about the phase transition. We can't really talk about percolation. We can't talk about multiple bubbles. And we don't know how this phase transition unfolds. At least we don't know how to compute it right now. What happens when, you know, there's some approximations that need to be made for calculating these rates that break down when the decay rate is too high? So we don't know really how to describe fast transitions that should kind of melt basically the crossover between a first order and a second order phase transition. Right now, the assumption in that cartoon I showed you of how the phase transition unfolds is that bubble nucleation events are completely uncorrelated. Is that really true? What about non-trivial initial states? Here we started purely in the false vacuum. What about excited states above the false vacuum? Cosmology is a time-dependent background. What happens in general in time-dependent backgrounds? So there's just a lot that we don't know, and it would be great if we could find a way to learn about it. So wouldn't it be nice? So here's where I motivate the field of experimental cosmology to try and solve this hard quantum problem. Wouldn't it be nice if we could make a little universe in the lab and learn about these questions? If we could build an experiment that we could probe and tune and change? Well, yeah, awesome, let's do it. So this motivates what I would call quantum simulation question?
Yeah, just to go back a couple slides.
Sure.
Did you mean this is a problem to do with calculation?
Yeah.
And then you're switching now to experimental. experiments? Is that the, or do you not know whether this is a problem to do with calculation or to do with underlying theory that you were talking about?
So, you know, the underlying theory is just run-of-the-mill quantum field theory. So I don't think there's any problem with the theory. The way we compute all these things currently is using Euclidean techniques. And so step one of the calculation is to stop talking about Lorentzian time evolution. And so anything that has to do with real-time evolution is kind of out the window with current calculational techniques, right? Non-perturbative nonlinear tells me that computationally, this is going to be a difficult problem, although if you hang on, I'll tell you some ways that you might imagine doing that. But you might start from the premise that doing that computation, you know, is really something that you need quantum computation to do. And I don't know that building the system that has the same properties that we think these early universe phase transitions might have had versus writing a computer program on classical or quantum hardware, what might be an easier problem? So I'm going to start talking about the let's do this in the lab, and then after that, I'll tell you about how thinking about how you might want to do that actually inspires ways to approximately solve this problem on a classical computer. That's a good question. Okay, so I'm like a recent convert, and I'm here to proselytize to you, as most recent converts are very excited about this field that's existed for a long time, but I just got into, okay? And that is this idea of quantum simulation. And the context that I'm going to talk about it in, or, you know, basically is, can we build a system in the laboratory that's an analogy or an approximation to this scalar field theory with a false vacuum that we can use to simulate processes in the early universe? And this particular process is the one that I'm going to focus on. And you can think of it kind of like an analog quantum computer, you know, like stringing together a bunch of capacitors and inductors to solve a differential equation with wires. Here, you know, the idea is to build a system that does one thing. It's not a universal quantum computer that will do anything you want, but it's a system that will compute this one thing for you, hopefully. And lots of cool stuff is happening in this realm. So, you know, it's been more than 40 years since Bill Unruh suggested that you might study black hole evaporation with sound horizons in fluids. And it's been a little bit more than 20 years since it was first suggested you might be able to use things like Bose-Einstein condensates as an analog system to study the early universe, say quantum fields during inflation. But now people are doing really cool stuff in the lab. It's actually happening. So I've just listed some recent papers here. It's a completely non-exhaustive list, but just things that I've read and thought were really cool. So you know, looking at phonons and BECs, people have been able to simulate the behavior of massless scalars in anti-de Sitter space, where the geometry is basically the distribution of density in this background BEC. People have studied inflation in the context of an expanding ring of a one-dimensional system of a BEC. People have looked at pair creation in expanding universes with ion traps, Schwinger pair production in graphene. There's a lot of different systems that people are looking at in the lab that are starting to really do stuff, real stuff, that might inform us about physics we're interested in the early universe. And so, I don't know, if you've never looked at this stuff, I encourage you to read it. Like, again, like, it's really cool. It's just amazing what is becoming possible to do in the laboratory. Now is my plug. I'm a member of this QSIMFP consortium, as are some other people in the room. which is a group of theorists and experimentalists in the UK and Canada who are trying to build laboratory experiments to learn about fundamental physics like false vacuum decay and black holes. And if you want to learn more about this and you happen to be in Waterloo about a month from now, you should come to this conference and hear about all the cool stuff that's happening in this consortium and other stuff too. So that's my advertisement. Okay, now to the physics. So what's an example of one of these quantum simulators or analog systems that might help us describe false vacuum decay?
In the discussions of Unruh and others of simulation of Hawking radiation, mm-hmm. there's also discussions of whether there's a universality class that is relevant. Is that something that's part of the argument here as well?
I'm not sure. No, I mean, maybe I don't know precisely that conversation, so be happy to discuss more. But universality in the sense that you can identify phonons or fluctuations in a system that obey wave equations and that you can engineer to either evolve in some background geometry or interact in a way that you wish them to interact. If that's the kind of universality you're talking about, then yes. So here's the prototype. Here's the prototype system of how you might simulate false vacuum decay. So consider two species Bose-Einstein condensate, where the two species are basically some split atomic state. Then an approximate way to describe this two-component condensate is through the Gross-Pitiyevsky equations. And so we've got the usual Schrodinger equation you're used to, plus nonlinear terms here that describe basically two-to-two scattering interactions between these different atomic species or themselves. And then in general, we can mix these atomic states by irradiating the system so that there's some probability a propagating atom will transition to the other atomic state. So you've got scattering and mixing. And if you change basis, where the wave function is now described in terms of a density and a phase, and then in a Lagrangian description, you can integrate out the density and the total phase. If you're interested in the details, you can look at this paper where we do that in detail. You end up with this effectively as your propagating fluctuating degree of freedom at low temperatures, and it's the only state that's not hugely gapped. The time derivatives are related to the density, details. But what you get is what looks like a relativistic kinetic term here for this scalar field, which is the difference in the phase of the two wave functions for the two species, and a potential that looks like cosine. And that cosine potential is proportional to this mixing parameter, so it basically arises from the mixing matrix between these two atomic states. So point, you have a non-trivial vacuum structure. Okay. Here you have multiple vacua, but they all have the same energy. Okay. And this was proposed a long time ago, like 20 plus years ago, as a way to make simulated domain walls, or to study axions in a BEC. Yeah, so if you consider linear fluctuations in all the variables, the densities and the phases, then this is the leading order quadratic Lagrangian. Yeah.
Right, and therefore I'm confused by the cosine because it's not a linear function or a quadratic function of the phase. So,
So I think we get that effectively from the e to the I phi here and here.
Maybe you're only linearizing in the amplitude, not the phase.
Yeah, I think we linearize in the density only. That's a good point. But let's look at that later. So then you realize, you remember, well, you look at this equation, and if I forget about this, this is just the pendulum, right? If I find the equations of motion, it's just the equation of motion for a pendulum. And you're like, oh yeah, that one time I taught undergraduate physics, there's this cool thing called the Kapitza pendulum, where if you shake the base of a pendulum, you can get a metastable state where the pendulum oscillates straight up. And if you push it too hard, it reverts to its lowest energy state, which is where the pendulum is oscillating, pointing down, okay? And so if we take this mixing term and we oscillate it in time, then time average, you get a potential that looks like this. Okay. And as a function basically of the amplitude and frequency of the oscillation, you can engineer a potential like this dark red one that has now a false vacuum state. The other degree of freedom would be the phases and densities. And those I'll come back to. But you basically have to check that you don't excite them and that this is a reasonable description of the propagating and fluctuating degrees of freedom. Yeah. So they're still there, but they're largely decoupled. You need to make sure you don't turn them on to begin with and that they don't get turned on at some later time. So then you can put those equations into a computer and simulate the Gross-Pitayevsky equation in something called the truncated Wigner approximation, which is basically adding fluctuations that are consistent with the uncertainty principle and let things go. So for low values of lambda, small values of lambda, we basically have the cosine, okay? And so if I tried to start the evolution with the universe everywhere in the false vacuum and see what happens to this relative phase variable, well, in some places you fall off to the right, and in some places you fall off to the left, the right being red, the left being blue, and you build this system of domain walls, and you get the usual kibble thing where you build basically a network of domain walls, and some regions inhabit the blue phase and some regions inhabit the red phase. And so this is an approximation to what might happen if you did this experiment in the lab. This might be the movie you could watch if you could actually measure everything. Okay, and then if you jack up lambda, so you increase the amplitude, for example, of this modulated coupling, then you get a false vacuum, and so the universe hangs out near the top for a little bit longer, and then locally you see these transitions, bubbles form, where in some regions you form a bubble that goes to the right, and in some regions you form bubbles that go to the left, and then they expand and percolate. And the cool thing is that this looks like pretty much how you would have predicted, given that scalar field Lagrangian, okay?
Sorry, did you say this is two-dimensional?
Yeah, so this is a two-space and one-time-dimensional simulation. But you can study this in one dimension, two dimension, three dimensions. I haven't talked about actual experiments yet, but the actual experiments are hopefully going to happen in a two-plus-one-dimensional system, effectively. And then if we go to even larger lambda, then the vacuum becomes more stable, and here there's periodic boundary conditions, but this bubble happened to nucleate on this point and then expand. Okay. As the decay rate gets slower, some cool things happen. The bubble looks more and more like a perfect circle, or in three dimensions, it would look more and more like a perfect sphere. And the evolution looks more and more like what you would have predicted from Coleman, from the original description of vacuum decay.
The initial state you put here, like a Gaussian?
Yeah, so this is like the ground state fluctuations in these propagating degrees of freedom. Yeah, centered on the false vacuum, correct. And if you want to learn more about these simulations, then all the details are in this paper. So can we do it? There is a lab in Cambridge run by Zoran Hadzebabic, where we hope to do this as part of this QSIM-FP consortium. So right now, there is a BEC formed in a two-dimensional trap. And there are many in-practice challenges. And I'm a theorist, and I don't know anything about them. Let me just be totally upfront and honest. But as a theorist, there are many kind of in-principle challenges that I'm worried about and questions that I'm worried about. So one of the first things we did when we learned about this proposed system of a two-component BEC making domain walls and potentially false vacua was the fact that you're shaking it with this time-dependent coupling. And as any cosmologist worth their snuff knows, that's going to drive parametric resonance. And so so there's this in principle question, which is, yes, you do drive a parametric resonance. And in answer to Gosel's question, that makes all these other modes turn on. And that's bad, because now you're not getting this relativistic scalar field theory, but a mess. And then so you need to worry about the time scale. And then it's a question of tuning knobs. Can you make that time scale for the system to fall apart way longer than the time scale on which you make these bubbles? And I think the answer is yes. These expanding bubble walls, so you saw this movie of the expanding bubble. Inside the walls, they're basically length contracting as they expand. And that's a huge pain in the butt for these systems, because there's an intrinsic length scale in a BEC called the healing length, where the physics changes. And so eventually the bubbles expand, their lab frame wall size gets small enough that you start probing new physics. That's kind of cool. I don't know, I never thought about that before, but there is this UV sensitivity in an expanding bubble wall. And in a BEC, you need to worry about that UV sensitivity. What we think happens in these systems is eventually the bubble expands, and then it ends up contracting, which we've seen in some of the simulations we've done. You need to worry about, like, how faithful is this analog? So one way you can do that is try and compute conserved charges, like energy and momentum in these scalar field theories, and see how bad is the violation. And I think in this system that's being built, it's going to be like 10% violated. So not amazingly great, but kind of OK. Let me get through the list, and I'll answer your question. We should ask, like, what should we be measuring? You can't make a movie like I showed in these experiments, but you basically have to destroy the system to figure out what it was doing. So you need to make many realizations and then worry about what it is you actually want to measure. How do you compare these results to theory? You know, like, what's the predicted rate? What does it have to do with the scalar field theory we're trying to simulate? When are we going to observe quantum vacuum decay versus thermal vacuum decay? Because the system is at a finite temperature, it will never be at zero temperature. What is the right temperature? So there are all these in principle, challenges and questions that we're working on. So hopefully when those are overcome by these smart people, we can learn something novel. Yeah, you had a question.
Do you expect a particle production out of vacuum?
If I were to describe what this is, this is like gazillion particle production. Because you have this conspiracy of all these fluctuations coming together to make what I like to think of as kind of a big bound state. Okay. It's like particle production. but in a non-perturbative, non-linear sense. Yeah. It's really forming this bound state.
Well, maybe the question, a part of that question is, does the time-dependent oscillation in the coupling create particles just like linearly out of the vacuum?
Totally, yeah, it does, definitely.
Important, or is it small enough that you can ignore that effect?
It's an awesome question, and you need to answer that question if you want to learn something about quantum vacuum decay. Yep. Yep. It's really about knob tuning. It's like, can we actually realize experimentally a regime where the quantum effects are important enough to see? I think the answer is yes, but that's an open question. Yeah? Sergey?
Yes, so when you said that you share configuration of charges, actually, yeah, can you elaborate on that? What charges?
Yeah, just the total energy in the system, right? So.
So it's not conserved in like an actual lab system. It's not conserved.
No. Because you have the relative phase mode, and it doesn't talk very strongly to the density modes, for example, or the total phase mode, but it does a little bit, and so energy is leaking out or leaking in,
and into other modes.
Yeah, leaking into other modes exactly. And so.
And also, this external source can does it.
Yeah, and then you have to worry about the time-dependent coupling. Is that driving an increase in the total energy? And the answer is yes, but then it's just a question of how quickly it's growing, right? Mm-hmm. Yep.
I guess another question is, at what stage of the bubble formation and growth process does the linearization that led to this effective field theory break down?
Yeah, that's related to Sergey's question. So you look at the conservation of these charges. And the answer to that question, I think, and this is something I don't have a plot to share with you about, is basically until the wall's length contract enough to reach near the healing length, that's when things go really bad. But before that time, it's pretty good. Yeah,
it's actually a comment. I think it's actually a very interesting system because you are studying post-vacuum decay in effective theory, and actually you don't know whether it's allowed or not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's kind of a good test bed for that, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Right. But you can tell me when I'm nearly out of time. I'll just blab for the rest of the talk about all the cool stuff that came out of just thinking about this problem. So even if these experiments never happen, are never realized in the lab, I think it's caused a really awesome rethink, at least for me and my collaborators, about how we should think about vacuum decay and how we might describe it now on classical computers, to come back to your computation versus experiment question. And again, this is kind of just an advertisement, thought about how you can have an approximate real-time dynamical description of vacuum decay at leading order in H-bar. We've computed the correlation function between bubble nucleation sites, and it's non-trivial and interesting. There's really interesting connections of bubbles and RG, a bit related to this UV sensitivity question of the walls. Like, you know, really you can probe new physics because you probe arbitrarily high energy inside the walls of the bubble in some sense. There are interesting bubble nucleation precursors, and fact, bubbles don't nucleate at rest. So let me describe a little bit about this until I run out of time. First, let's start with this real-time semi-classical approach. So you might remember from quantum mechanics, if I have the harmonic oscillator and I compute the expectation values, that the expectation value of x of t is basically the classical x of t, and the expectation value of p of t is the classical p of t. And for nonlinear potentials, this is your lesson on Ehrenfest theorem, if you recall. This is approximately true effectively as long as this state is localized well compared to the scale on which you start to see nonlinearities in the potential. And you can extend this to statements about the time evolution of this quantum state, the full thing, not just the expectation values, using a technology called the Wigner function. And this is a quasi-probability distribution quasi because it's not guaranteed to be positive definite on phase space. Okay. But luckily for the simple harmonic oscillator, the ground state of the simple harmonic oscillator is just a Gaussian. And that's positive definite on phase space. So if you've ever seen cool movies of the evolution of the Wigner functional for the harmonic oscillator, it just looks like a Gaussian that moves around centered on the classical trajectory in phase space, which is just a circle for the harmonic oscillator. And if you have a quadratic potential, then you can show that classical evolution of the Wigner function is basically just a rewriting of the Schrodinger equation. So you can time evolve the full quantum state, the full quantum ground state. So maybe that's not super interesting, but it's interesting that you can do it. Sergey, you had a question, a comment.
Linear order, so the linear semiclassical order, isn't it?
Nope. For a quadratic potential, it's exact.
Ah, for quadratic. Okay, yes. But not for nonlinear.
But not for nonlinear, but it's the leading order in H bar term. Yeah. For a nonlinear potential. Okay. So here's a recipe for evolving the Wigner function. You can create an ensemble of harmonic oscillators with initial conditions that are just fairly drawn from this probability distribution. You time evolve it with the classical Hamiltonian, and then you resample it at some later point in time. And basically, by brute force in this way, you can compute the time evolution of this probability distribution on phase space. And as Sergey mentioned, that's only approximate for a nonlinear potential. So in field theory, you can copy this idea. So you just promote functions to functionals, do an expansion in H-bar in this nonlinear potential. This is like the field theory version of Ehrenfest's theorem, if you've done that derivation before. And then, you know, basically you get something that looks like classical evolution of the initial state. If you want to really turn up the crank, you can add this stochastic quantum noise terms. I have no idea how to do that, but I think it's possible. And so if we forget about this higher order in H-bar stuff for a massive scalar, well, for a massive scalar, this doesn't exist. For a massive scalar, quantum effects, so the only thing we mean by quantum field theory and of the ground state at least, it's all in the initial state, right? There's nothing else. There's no loops, anything like that. It's just the initial state. And interactions, so nonlinearities, lead to additional effects, but those are higher order in H-bar. So to leading order in H-bar, when we think of quantum field theory, right, it's just the initial state. It's the uncertainty principle. That's it. No loops, nothing like that. So that's the idea. Basically, if we can put our system into some initial state centered on this false vacuum, it more or less looks like just a massive scalar to leading order in H-bar. We can do the evolution, the time evolution of this state using that recipe I showed you. Make a realization where the initial conditions are consistent with the uncertainty principle, time evolve it with the classical Hamiltonian, do it again and again and again, and that's your ensemble. And that's supposed to be telling you something about the evolution of this quantum state. This is basically what cosmologists do in preheating, thinking about how the formation of cosmic strings work in different contexts. And you know, it's an approximation, so it's leading order in H-bar, because quantum mechanics is in the initial conditions, but not in the evolution, but it's still nonlinear, because I have a nonlinear Hamiltonian. So it's all the tree-level interactions. But the only H-bar is in the initial conditions. And the way I like to think about bubbles in this context, they're like these many-particle states, okay? So there's some bound state of these modes with the right phase. And as a many-particle state, maybe a semi-classical description is OK. You can compare this to the predictions for the decay rate. That turns out to be super, super subtle for the reason of these RG effects, because I don't know. I know how to do RG around a minimum, but I don't really know how to do RG inside the wall around a maximum. I'm really running out of time, so you know, like I'm just going to gloss over this, but ask me. Within this framework, it's really easy to see that these bubbles are biased tracers of these quantum vacuum fluctuations, and so therefore they should be correlated because there's some threshold where I get a large enough in amplitude field fluctuation, and then I make a bubble. Just like in Preschecter, I have a large enough amplitude overdensity, and then I make a dark matter halo. And you can find out what the correlation function is in space and time. And I'll end with this. Okay, so here's a quiz. Here's a question. I will buy anyone who can answer this question a coffee, but they're free. I'll make it for you. I know how to steam milk on the machine downstairs. Okay, so what is the most likely time evolution of a large fluctuation away from thermal equilibrium? Anyone have a guess?
In what system?
Any system. Does it just poof into existence?
Towards thermal equilibrium.
Excellent answer. Thank you very much, Lee. So it's the CPT conjugate of the most likely way the system relaxes back to equilibrium, right? That's a general prediction. And so you can think about thermal simulations, something I've been thinking about with Sergey and my student Dalila. And it's really cool because for thermal bubbles, they're basically this configuration in unstable equilibrium between collapse and expansion. And you can ask, what does the thermal bubble do when it collapses? And whatever, 12 years ago, we predicted that it would look like this thing called an oscillon, which is a localized time-dependent field configuration. And so if you take the time reverse of the formation of these thermal bubbles, it's basically, there's this like oscillon tail. So there's this bubble precursor. And so a cool question to ask in all this is like, well, do these bubbles just pop into existence like quantum mechanics is magic? No, they kind of have this precursor. There's something that happens before, and it's really interesting to think about that. Okay, so experimental cosmology. The basic question is, can these lab-based systems, quantum computers, whatever, teach us something new about the early universe? I hope so. Cosmology is dynamics. I think this is a really interesting, fertile ground to talk to people in other fields that are interested in quantum dynamics and know a lot more about quantum dynamics. What's the goal of all this? Of course, I want to connect back to observation. Like, is there something interesting beyond the two numbers we currently know how to predict in the power spectrum that could help us learn about the early universe? And then maybe we can come back to these sort of big questions. How do we understand systems with accelerated expansion, quantum gravity, non-perturbative effects, et cetera? So thanks very much.
Yeah, one thing you said, I'm a bit puzzled. You said you think of a bubble as a many particle state, but a bubble is supposed to be a false vacuum, which is a state of nothing. I mean, how do you reconcile those perspectives?
Well, I can define particles as fluctuations around the false vacuum. And these bubbles are just, you know, the magical combination of those fluctuations that gets you over the barrier. And so in that sense, I think about it as a bound state of those particles.
Okay, and then one other thing. When you had the I guess it was bigger lambda, the red and blue bubbles appear.
Yep.
It looked to me like the red bubbles, when they hit the blue ones, always won. Was that a coincidence, or is there a reason for that?
No, they had an equal vacuum energy, so the one that wins is the one that had been expanding for the longer time.
Okay.
And it was just an accident of that realization that
so
that one particular color happened first.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
In general, they'll compete equally, right? Sort of.
Yeah, in general, there's like all sorts of cool stuff you can learn about those interactions. Yeah.
Okay, one more question.
You said that bubbles don't nucleate at rest. Is there a reason why you have expected them to nucleate at rest? And this is surprising?
Only if you've been brainwashed by reading the same papers over and over and over again would you think that they form at rest. Because they're all written in this Euclidean picture where there's no real time. and then you analytically continue from this Euclidean picture to a Lorentzian picture. And the condition under which you can do that is to assume everything is at rest.
Hold on a second. What does rest mean?
Phi dot is zero everywhere. The time derivative of the fields are zero everywhere. So I have a field configuration, that's my bubble, and it just forms momentarily in a state. Well, this is the usual picture. It forms momentarily in a state where all the time derivatives of phi are zero.
Right, but time and space are mixed up by Lorentz boosts, and yep. They're starting with a Lorentz invariant state.
Yeah.
So what do you even need?
Awesome question, Ted. We're puzzling over that. I mean, it's weird, right? Yeah, I don't know. But you can't answer that question with this Euclidean picture. Yeah.
Okay, I think on that unresolved note. So please hold the rest of your questions to Matt for lunch, and let's thank him again. Thanks.